from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
As part of our special broadcast from WAMU in Washington, D.C. on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we'll talk with historian Taylor Branch about the life and legacy of the iconic civil rights activist. We'll take your calls and questions, and we want to hear your reflections on civil rights today. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny, and we're live from the nation's capital this morning at WAMU. In fact, I'm in D.C. all week long with my KQED colleagues, Guy Marzorati and Miranda Leitzinger. We're covering the inauguration, and on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we're spending this hour of Forum looking at a fuller picture of African-American history, from slavery to the Jim Crow era to the civil rights movement with Dr. King, through the Black Lives Matter and different race issues today. And let's kick things off with this excerpt from the I Have a Dream speech that Dr. King delivered at the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963.
Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
And joining me first this hour is author and historian Taylor Branch. He is, of course, a master storyteller. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his extraordinary work chronicling the history of race and the civil rights era in this nation, specifically the role of Martin Luther King Jr. and the role he played. Taylor Branch, welcome to Forum. So good to have you on this holiday.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to be with you.
You know, listening to that excerpt of that very famous, iconic speech, I stopped on the word freedom, and I wonder if you think the meaning of freedom and what it meant to Martin Luther King Jr. on that day, does it mean something different today to African Americans?
No, I think freedom has been it's where the anthem and the anguish of the civil rights community joins the purpose of America. I mean, if America's about freedom, then it's a question of, does it apply to everyone? And so I think freedom songs, the freedom movement, in fact, most people that I know from the movement call it the freedom movement rather than the civil rights movement, because civil rights simply means rights pertaining to citizenship.
Back then, of course, Dr. King was concerned with segregation, with the lack of voting rights for African Americans. Those issues, in large measure, have been resolved, although the voting rights issue is back again.
Yeah, the vote is the fundamental building block of democracy, and if you'll notice, even in that speech, Dr. King didn't talk about segregation. He talked about freedom that would apply to everybody, and notably at the very end, he didn't say that black people would be able to join the Americans. He said that white people and black people would be able to join together. So he was inviting white America into the words of a spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty we're free at last, is in a way, it's kind of backward from the way most people think of it. They think that he was begging to be for black people to be admitted into kind of white democracy, when really what he was doing was inviting all of America to sing a black spiritual, because that spiritual went so much to the heart of the patriotic purpose of America.
What do you make of what transpired this weekend? We talked about it in the first hour a little bit. The comments, first of all, from Congressman John Lewis, who, of course, is a civil rights icon, saying that he didn't think President-elect Trump was legitimate. He wasn't going to attend the inauguration. And then the comments from President-elect Trump after that, attacking John Lewis is all talk, no action. What do you make of that?
Well, it shows how race is consistently submerged beneath the surface of our politics as a driving issue that people don't like to talk about. But when it does surface, it surfaces with a lot of feeling. You know, I'm not objective here. John Lewis is an old friend of mine. I went to his wedding in 1968. We were delegates together to the Chicago Convention in 1968 when I was a kid. So we go back a long way. I think it's preposterous to say that he's all talk and no action. I mean, ironically, in the civil rights movement, among his colleagues, he was criticized for being all action and not much talk. He was always ready to march and sacrifice, and he went to jail more than 40 times and was beaten numerous times. So in that sense, it's quite apart from how inappropriate it might be for a president to be tweeting before he takes office in personal attacks. The substance of it is pretty misguided. It's not that unusual. Well, didn't surprise me for John to say he was going to boycott the inauguration. It did surprise me that he used the word illegitimate, because we all know that underneath all of our fightings over how fair elections are, which have gone on for the history of this country, we all want to legitimize elections and honor them. And that's really what makes America more distinct than anywhere else, is that we don't have fights over elections except during the Civil War.
But, of course, the comments and the back and forth on Twitter, it's really about much more than John Lewis and Donald Trump, right? I mean, this is
sure.
What does this say to you about the attitude that Donald Trump may have as president, or that you fear he may have as president, when it comes to African-Americans, Latinos, and others? I mean, does he – we have to presume, give him the benefit of the doubt, that he knows the history of John Lewis before he made that tweet.
Well, I think he knows the headlines of the history of John Lewis. I doubt that he knows it in very much detail, but surely he knows that he led the march at Selma and that other people consider him an icon. In that sense, I think that it's not unusual with the way Trump got elected in the first place, because he, from the very beginning of his campaign, attacking President Obama, saying that he wasn't a legitimate American, he has been making explicit and bringing to the surface charges that have normally been coded in American politics, in his attacks on saying we had to have law and order, and that that the inner cities in Black America is a disaster, and attacks on various ethnic groups. I think Trump has showed that he's not afraid to raise things to the surface that are normally kept below ground.
Talking with Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of the trilogy on Martin Luther King Jr., and he'll be with us for the hour. If you'd like to join us with your thoughts on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, give us a call. We're going to open the phone lines a little bit early, and you can feel free to join us. And I'm in D.C., and I'm having a hard time finding the phone number. So if I could get my producer to put that up there, I can give it out. It's we'll do that 866-733-6786. There we go. 866-733-6786. You can also send your comments to forum at kqed.org, put a comment on our Facebook page, or find us on Twitter at KQED Forum. Taylor Branch, it's been almost a half century, it will be in another year and a half or so, since Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. What is the relevance of his message today in 2017?
Well, I frankly, I think that the message of Martin Luther King is about the future, not really about the past, because the relevance of that message was always that the American challenge to fulfill the democratic experiment, the American experiment, is difficult. It's a challenge to everyone. It goes beyond race, but it has always been grounded in race from the very first compromises at the Constitutional Convention and the biggest crisis we've had in the Civil War up through the Civil Rights era. And therefore, I think one way to look at it is that Dr. King is saying America has been about race, whether we want to acknowledge that or not, and that when we do deal forthrightly across the lines that divide us, good things tend to happen, not just for black people and white people, but for everybody else. I mean, he said that the freedom movement was spreading the widest liberation in human history in 1964, and that it would affect everyone, including the white South, which was liberated economically by the end of segregation, women, senior citizens, and even King didn't dream about the kinds of liberation that would follow for, say, gay and lesbian Americans when you start dealing on the basis of equal citizenship and reaching across the lines that divide us. So the civil rights movement is really about American patriotism in its largest sense. And what it really says is that we hide behind our misgivings and our fears and our biases on race at our peril for America, because when we do that, we go backwards, and when we face up to it, we go forward.
What, Dr. King, of course, preached nonviolence and forgiveness, love, reconciliation, those kinds of things. And the Black Lives Matter movement today has been criticized by some civil rights leaders for lacking some of that kind of sentiment. What are your thoughts about the civil rights movement today? And, of course, it's more than just Black Lives Matter, but including that group.
Well, I think Black Lives Matter is a movement in formation, as far as I could tell. I mean, it's like the Wall Street, the 1% movement a few years ago. It doesn't have a central message that is formulated. There are people in, as I understand it, I've gone to a couple of meetings in cities and campuses all over the country trying to formulate a message that can galvanize opinion. So I would say that it's not as well formulated or developed into a program and into demands as Dr. King's movement was. Now, he put nonviolence at the heart of his message right from the beginning, from the boycott to the very end. And he was unusual because he got more committed to nonviolence as at the same time that other people got tired of it. And said, why can't we be as violent as white people? How come nonviolence is only for black folks, but otherwise Americans like James Bond? He said that nonviolence is not just a Christian principle, but it's the very basic building block of democracy, which is the vote. And that if you believe in democracy, you believe in votes, and every vote is nothing but a piece of nonviolence. That's what we're trying to do, is figure out how to create justice with votes, meaning nonviolently. So he says, don't fool yourself into thinking that nonviolence is just some esoteric thing for Gandhians who don't step on insects or eat strange diets. Nonviolence is at the heart of democracy, and that we kind of ignore that at our peril.
Yeah. We are almost at the very end of 8 years of the first African-American president, and yet as Barack Obama prepares to leave office, it seems in some ways the racial divides in our country have never been starker than they are today. At least that's how it seems to many. And how do you see that? I mean, we certainly see it in terms of police relations with communities of color, and there are, you could say in this election as well, it was, you know, racial issues were either subtly or not so subtly brought to the fore. Are things worse today? I mean, President Obama would say, I think you're forgetting history if you think that.
I think that things are much better you couldn't imagine having a black president 50 years ago. You couldn't imagine the black presence in our culture as prominently as it is and as large as the black middle class has become. On the other hand, I think things are in some senses the same in that race is at the underpinnings of our politics to a much larger degree than we want to discuss. We tend to separate regular politics from race politics, so we stop having regular politics, which you see on all the cable news shows. Whenever there's a race crisis, we talk about race for a while, and then we go back to politics. What we've never been able to do is to have race an accepted part at the heart of our politics, rather than being two alternative realities. Race is right at the heart of it, and in many respects, it's gotten worse in the last 50 years, not by the objective conditions, but the way we talk about race or don't talk about it, because cynicism about government has probably been the defining and most prominent idea in politics for the last 50 years, really since the civil rights era of the 1960s. People started cussing government when they couldn't endorse segregation. And so we're dealing with a lot of that cumulative burden that we don't believe through politics we can tackle our toughest problems. And there's a racial component in that really paralyzed Barack Obama to a large degree. He couldn't talk about race very much while he was president, and I know for a fact that most of his advisors had a conniption whenever he did because they knew bad things were going to happen.
He learned that very early on with that incident in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Skip Gates. And he had to give a whole major address in Philadelphia because of his relationship with Jeremiah Wright very early on, and the people around him saw that as a major effort to extricate himself from something that he didn't even do. So that he was very, very sensitive about that, whereas I think you could argue that Donald Trump didn't pay a significant political price at all for saying that he was not an American, that Obama, you know, for launching the birther movement, saying that he was literally illegitimate to be our president, not symbolically illegitimate, if that's what John Lewis is saying, because the election was tainted. So we don't have a level cultural playing ground where race is concerned in American politics, because Donald Trump insulted President Obama preposterously and made a name for himself to get elected president, whereas President Obama has always known that if he invokes race explicitly, even from his own experience, which is what he knows best, it's likely to set off some sort of firestorm or people feeling wounded or dishonored.
Yeah, well, and I think that's one reason a lot of people, including me, are really looking forward to reading his book, because once he leaves office, I think he will obviously be able to write things that he maybe couldn't say or didn't want to say while he was in the White House.
I hope so. Unfortunately, there's not a big bookshelf of really candid presidential memoirs. The best presidential memoirs in history are U.S. Grant's, and that may be because he didn't really write much about his presidency or the end of Reconstruction. He wrote mostly about being a Civil War general.
Talking with Taylor Branch, historian and author, of course, of the trilogy on Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. If you'd like to join us, give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. You can also, of course, leave a comment on our Facebook page or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Let's go to the phones now. And Ben in Oakland, you're our first listener. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My name is Ben. I'm a lawyer from Oakland, California. I just wanted to comment on the distinguished speaker's comment about John Lewis and saying that Donald Trump was not an illegitimate president. I personally would have criticized him for that maybe 4 years ago, 8 years ago. But now when you combine the influence of Russia perhaps in this election, and in addition to Comey's influence on the result of the election with his comments about Hillary Clinton and the reopening of the scandal in August, combined with, I think, the overall voter suppression that's going on in various states throughout the country, combined with Republicans' effort to redistrict and suppress the votes of minorities and the poor people other ways in terms of disenfranchisement of so many ex-convicts. When you combine that all together, it really is a sense of, I think, of all people that the will of Americans is not being reflected in the results of the election. I mean, you have Clinton, who won the vote by 2 million, and yet not only do we have a Republican president, but we have an overwhelming Republican majority in Congress as well as a majority in the Senate. And when you look at that all together...
Yeah. Well, and I think that, some of that, of course, has to do with redistricting, and a lot of it does, as a matter of fact, especially the congressional issues. Taylor Branch, what are your thoughts about that? And, one of the reasons Hillary Clinton lost is that the African-American vote was far lower than it had been in the last two presidential elections.
Well, some of that is turnout, because the turnout wasn't as much as it was for Barack Obama, which is to be expected. But some of that is voter suppression also, which goes to the caller's point. I agree with all of the points he made about the fact that there are anti-democratic forces in American politics that taint this election, and that many of them are grounded in race, including the malapportionment of the House of Representatives. And I've often said on the air that to me the saddest thing is that we've had gridlock driven by malapportionment for decades, but you almost never hear anybody say, well, where does this gridlock come from and what's driving it? And what's driving it to me is that the gerrymanders are done by race to concentrate Republican voters in some districts and minority voters of all kinds in Democratic districts. It's just statistically sound. And that they're created for minimal rather than maximum competitiveness in those districts. And it's a Democratic failure with race at the center. I wish there were more people saying, this is a cause of gridlock. How do we get out of it? How do we diagnose it? What is a more Democratic way to run apportionment? We need to be having little constitutional conventions around that.
You open that. That's a can of worms, too. A lot of people would be reluctant to do that for other reasons. But, many people would like to change that system, no question about it. Taylor Branch will be with us for the rest of this hour. And we're also going to be joined next by Mary Elliott, who is with the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. She's the co-curator of their Slavery and Freedom exhibit. And we'd love you to join us. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny. We're broadcasting from Washington, D.C., the studios of WAMU. Stay with us. On this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we're broadcasting from Washington, D.C. We're here for the inaugural events of this week. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny, and talking with Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of several books on Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement. And before I bring in our next guest, let's hear just another excerpt from a speech Dr. King gave, this one in Selma, Alabama, in March of 1965.
A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true. So we're going to stand up right here amid horses. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy clubs. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas. Yes. We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up, yes, letting the world know, yes, that we are determined to be free.
Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in Selma, Alabama, with, again, that call for nonviolence and the immoral authority that he had with that point of view in the face of so much violence around him and directed at him and his fellow protesters. Joining us now is someone who has helped to bring these stories and so many others to people who have been visiting the Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture. We're joined by Mary Elliott. She is a museum specialist for that museum, curator of Slavery and Freedom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you today, and particularly on this special day. So thank you.
It is a special day and a busy one, I'm sure, for the museum and for you. So thanks for taking some time. I have to ask you, before we get to other issues, about what's been in the news just in the past 24 hours. President-elect Trump apparently canceling a visit to the museum for reasons that were unclear. What is the museum? I realize you're not the spokesperson for the museum, but what are you hearing and what is the museum saying on the record?
Well, I think the best person to answer that question would be our director, Lonnie Bunch, but you know, the one thing I would say about our museum is it is a museum open to the public, open to all. We encourage everyone to come. Many people who come find that they learn things they had not known or even considered before. And what I know that I am very personally proud of, and I'm proud of what my colleagues have done to really help prompt deeper thought about what it is to be American and the many things that African Americans have done to help define this nation and define the meaning of freedom and equality and citizenship. So if President-elect Trump does come, then we're hopeful that he'll find some of those themes and in the stories that we presented and the objects that are on display and the very human experience that we presented in the museum.
Well, and if you were given the chance to give him a personal tour, what would you most like him to see?
You know, it's someone might say, well, you know, Mary, you know, you have to think something. But the truth is, for me, when I do a tour, really regardless of someone's status, I would give the same tour that I give to Oprah Winfrey or President Trump or to, and I'm using this just as a name, but Miss Johnson, who may sit out on her front porch. And so when I say that all of these things are important to everybody. And I would want him to see the same thing that I show to everyone else. Because the most important thing is this is a very human story. It is a story that is an American story, and this is a shared history. And so in that, we start with, for example, in the Slavery and Freedom Exhibition, we start with the human experience in the continent of Africa, and we look at humanity in the context of that continent of Africa being a place of diverse people, places, cultures, intellect, societies, landscape, right? And we look at how Africans in the world shape the world and were shaped by the world, how they shape this nation, and I have to always go through this litany, economically, socially, politically, you know, culturally, intellectually. All of that is important, regardless of who the person is that I'm taking through the exhibition.
Are there some specific items in the museum, because it is so vast and there's so much to see, but are there some things that really stand out for you, even if it doesn't strike others the same way, but for you, what was it that moved you the most?
Well, some of the things that strike me, it's really there are objects and then there are design features. So we worked with a really dynamic design team, Ralph Applebaum and Associates, and it is a matter of how do you convey some of these themes through design. So I'll give you an example. When you first come into the Slavery and Freedom Exhibition, you encounter a graphic, a label, and it's the story of Queen Nzinga, who was a leader along the Western African coast in West Central Africa. She aligned with the Dutch, the Portuguese, the church, all to avoid having her people enslaved or being involved in the slave trade. But that story is juxtaposed with a quote from a European gentleman from the 1700s. And it says, while I admit I am sickened at the purchase of slaves, I must be mum, for what would we do without sugar or rum? And so for me, that's very powerful. It's not an object, but it's powerful that you see the humanity in the story of Queen Nzinga, who ultimately fights against the Portuguese. They turn against her. But then you see this story, this quote from this gentleman, and I tell people, look at the beginning of that. I admit I am sickened at the purchase of slaves. And I tell people from the very beginning, we encounter this issue of the moral question. What moral obligations do we have to each other? So for me, that's one of the most powerful things. But also looking at, for example, you talk about the humanity in this story. And many people wouldn't think that we would feature this in the museum, but we have a Fox's, it's a Fox wage book. And it's a wages book of wages that were paid to the crew members on a slave ship. And so I tell people you can look at this two ways. One, everyone benefited from the slave trade. But two, why would someone serve on a slave ship? It could be that they wanted to gain passage to the new world, they needed to feed their family, or they thought it was fine and they just wanted to make money. If you open up that wage book, you'll find that many people committed suicide or ran away. And so even in looking at that humanity, and we look at this story through the African-American lens, we would be remiss if we did not look at humanity across the board. And that is the human experience as well. So those are some of the things design-wise that I think are important, and that's an important object as well. Some of the more other objects that I think are important that really help us unpack the story of what it is to think about the development of this nation include something like Benjamin Banneker's Almanac. Someone might say, well, what does that have to do with what it is to be American? But the Almanac...
And just tell us who he was.
Benjamin Banneker was... one of the surveyors who helped lay out the federal city, Washington, D.C. And he's also a brilliant mind in terms of science and math. And he wrote this almanac. And he was a free African-American man. So he wrote this almanac, and we have a copy. It's a first edition of that almanac. And he gave a copy to President Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. And he sent him a note indicating that African-Americans were intellectual human beings who deserved to be free. And the almanac was an example of that brilliance. And Thomas Jefferson essentially told him that he was an exception to the rule and did not agree with him.
Yeah. Talking with Mary Elliott, a museum specialist with the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and also Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of the trilogy on Martin Luther King, Jr. If you'd like to join us this hour, tell us your thoughts about Dr. King. What do you think is his most important legacy? How connected do you feel to his work and its relevance today? Give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Taylor Branch, I'm sure you've been to the museum. As hard as it is to get a ticket, I imagine you got one, and I've been there probably numerous times. What was your takeaway? What did you learn as someone who knows so much about the civil rights movement and the history of African Americans in this country? What did you learn that you didn't know?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was quite an experience for me to go there even before it opened, after being in lots of meetings with Mary Elliott, among others, in the planning stages with our scholars committee over many years. I think I would just emphasize a couple of points she made about how personal it is, that we learn things through stories of people that connect us to larger ideas. The range of it, that it goes right from before the revolution and culture and intellect and the unbelievable story of bringing 11 million people across the ocean against their will to come here to the United States, and just into culture, into music, into things that are distinctively American that wouldn't be here without African American culture. But when I go through the museum, mostly what strikes me is how people can be so unconscious of how powerful race is. I mean, I think of one exhibit down in the basement. There's this big slab that was used as a slave auction slab. It's a big stone from Nashville, Tennessee, off which slaves were auctioned every day for, I don't know, 100 years or more. But the sign in Nashville that commemorated that stone afterward simply said that on this stone, President Andrew Jackson spoke, and also Henry Clay spoke, the great legislator of the 19th century. So that to the people who ran Nashville, it was significant because two politicians spoke there, and people were oblivious to the fact, or they didn't want to remember the fact that its everyday function was a place where black people were sold right there through slavery. So it helps us bridge the fact that on a very personal basis we live in different worlds as far as what we're aware of, and that we're all richer when we bridge those gaps and see the stories together. And that's why I think the museum is so powerful, and it surprises people who go in there that how big the story is.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones now. Kevin in Oakland, you're on Forum. Welcome. Kevin, are you there? Well, I don't. Let's go to Colin then in Santa Cruz. Colin, are you with us?
Hi, Colin. Hi. Yes.
Hey. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I like that last comment about bridging the gap with regards to different people and different cultures. My first year at UC Berkeley was 1983, and one of the first things symposiums I attended was the 20th anniversary of Martin Luther King for one of his speeches, and I cut out at the time a quote from someone who was advertised in a local paper of what a hero is. And he said, my heroes are those people who stand up for what they believe. Obviously, Martin Luther King falls in that category, John Lewis. But I want to say a comment made earlier was that nonviolence is, and paraphrasing, nonviolence is the hallmark of democracy. And I would actually probably change that to democracy is formed in the crucible of violence, with the aspiration of nonviolence, in that once a democratic structure gets put in place from a political system, from an economic system, from a societal system, maybe one can achieve nonviolence. But we've seen in our own country in the last couple hundred years, one of the more stable democracies on earth, violence continue towards the end or towards the pursuit of democratic ideals. And with regards to Donald Trump's comment about John Lewis, I think there are many heroes that have proposed nonviolent interaction and the ideals of collectivism of getting along together. But I think Donald Trump is also looking at what has someone done recently? What's the meritocracy of someone's work? Have they changed the actual congressional district in John Lewis's case for the better?
Well, let me just jump in because I think it's I'm not intimately familiar with that congressional district, but I think that his characterization of it as violent and run down is not accurate. There are many wealthy parts of the district. So I don't mean to cut you off, but I think there were parts of what Donald Trump was saying that just weren't really accurate. But your larger point about democracy and violence occasionally, and Taylor Branch, certainly even as Dr. King and his supporters were nonviolent, there were others practicing lynching and all kinds of other atrocities that were aimed at civil rights activists and even just regular black folks and white folks who went down there to help them.
Well, absolutely. But the point is that the nonviolent movement was trying to establish norms consistent with the aspiration of democracy to settle things by votes rather than by violence. And the most distinguishing mark of America in history is that except for the Civil War, whenever we've had elections, we've tended to fuss about them and argue and say they weren't fair, but we honor them and we don't break into wars and say we don't recognize that election, so let's fight about it. And that's something that should never be taken for granted. But the very fact that so much of our national life is governed by votes, and it's not just in Congress or the Supreme Court. I mean, this radio station probably runs on votes, and your church groups and everything else. And it is a civilized way of running things. And the civil rights movement was basically saying through nonviolence we can make this society more democratic by establishing ties even across the bitterest divides that we have. Being willing to die but not to kill is a pretty high standard of patriotism trying to make democracy function better.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Dennis in Berkeley, welcome.
Got a great program, and Taylor Branch is a magnificent historian. I highly respect him. I worked intimately with Dr. King in Cleveland, Ohio, back in the 1960s when I was minister of the Unitarian Church there. And I know when King and I talked on the phone, we were being overheard by the FBI deliberately. And J. Edgar Hoover made Dr. King's life miserable. He called him, he said he had the ethics of an alley cat. And it was most unfair, and I think that's one of the blemishes on the director of the FBI. And we should point this out, that it was totally unfair. And unfortunately, when Dr. King spoke out against the war in Vietnam, even Lyndon Johnson refused to honor his integrity. So
that was really the breaking point. But yeah. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Dennis. Appreciate it. We've got some listener comments here as well. Dan in Oakland writes, why do we have a white man talking about a black civil rights leader? I'm white, and I think it would be more productive to hear a non-white perspective. Taylor Branch, I think he's talking about you. Do you hear that comment often, or have you over the years?
Not from many people who read my books, but from people who don't. The civil rights movement is larger than any of us, and to some degree, it helped me. It was a barrier. I had trouble getting some interviews over. I spent 24 years doing this. On the other hand, there were times when it was a help because I was an outsider to an insider culture. And things that were taken for granted within the movement looked different. There's a constant tension between insiders and outsiders in culture. I mean, I think one of the reasons that our best comedians and artists have often been blacks and Jews from outsider cultures that see the humor and the art of the majority white culture gives them an advantage. And to me, it was just a larger story. I would never say that a black person couldn't write about the president or shouldn't be able to criticize J. Edgar Hoover. It's just that we have to take care about trying to relate to each other authentically as people across those lines.
All right, here's another comment from Chris, who writes, sometimes I find it curious or troubling that what is mentioned from the I Have a Dream speech is the part about the dream, but not the parts about police brutality and disenfranchisement. I believe that these parts of the speech are avoided or just less popular, but maybe point to what we need to speak about and deal with in order to heal. Either one of you, Taylor or Mary, have thoughts about that?
Well, actually, I wanted to add something to, if you don't mind, just the question that was just, or the comment that was just made about Taylor Branch's speaking to the civil rights movement. And I'm an African-American woman, and my family was heavily involved with the civil rights movement. And that was, it was an interracial effort. And to me, I think it's important to understand that while this museum talks about the American story through the African-American lens, that American story applies to everybody. And so Taylor Branch, I am deeply indebted to him, his commentary and insight when we had our review sessions going over the content for the museum, because of his, one, personal experiences and his dedication to this subject matter and his research. But the other thing is, this is not, the civil rights movement is not just a Black experience. And just like African Americans held the nation's feet to the fire, and by the time we get to the end of the Civil War, we get the Reconstruction Amendments that affect us all, then I think it's equally important that what happened in the civil rights movement affected everybody. And so I think that, you know, white or Black can speak to the significance of the legacy of those who were involved in the civil rights movement and the power of the civil rights movement and the impact of the civil rights laws. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, no, and it makes me think and appreciate all the landmines you must have to walk around and through having a museum like this. I mean, just take an issue like slavery or the Civil War. There are people who see those things very differently. And I heard you talking earlier about the importance of really empathy, I think is what you were saying, is seeing things from the point of view of different people, whether they were working on a slave ship or being brought over from an African country to work as slaves. That idea that you, if you're going to tell this history in a way that moves people and educates people so that they're different when they walk out the door, you need to take into account all those different points of view, Mary.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, we can take people on tours and we talk about the content and the objects and, you know, the design. I'm very excited about the fact that many of the posts on social media include, or a majority of them include, images of labels, and people are reading this content. But what's really powerful is if you look at the visitor engagement. And when you walk through this museum, you see Black, white, Asian Pacific Islander, Latino, American Indian, all looking at this history together, reading together, and giving each other space to digest it, reconcile with it, to think a little bit more deeply about it. And I think that's part of the power of the museum. And we're fortunate, as I said, to have had some of the guidance by people like Taylor Branch and others who really helped us get to this point.
I imagine that the portion in the museum about the first African-American president, Barack Obama, must have been, I don't know, I won't put words in your mouth. What was that like, participating in those discussions? What were the considerations you had? I mean, he's not really a part of history yet. He's very much in the present, at least till Friday. And the historians will take years and decades to really assess his presidency. But how did you approach it as a museum?
Well, it's a 21st century museum, and even though someone might say, well, he's not history yet, it's kind of like the Black Lives Matter movement. You collect now. It's important to be collecting now, you know, and to be mindful of what is a moment in time that is making an impact now and will have an impact, you imagine, down the road, right? So you collect now. And you collect not only objects, but stories. And you reflect on these moments now, and you continue to do so down the road. Collecting and working with, collecting from and working with the administration, I actually was not involved with that, but I know my colleagues really thought deeply about what are the things that you need to have to represent this moment. And they also thought about where do you end the story, right? And so do you end on, and then, you know, President Obama was elected and everything was fine. But that's not the story that you end on. So we continually reflected on what does this history mean and what is his place in this story. And it's a powerful one. But at the same time, you don't feel a case with just his personal objects. You also add things that the general public, what did it mean to them? And so we have, for example, buttons that people wore, that what this means to be part of that hope, you know, newspaper articles, different things that are featured in that case. You get a broad perspective of what the moment meant, the person means, all of that. So I hope that.
All right. Helps. And we have just less than 2 minutes left. And let me just bring it back to where we started. Taylor Branch with Donald Trump Friday. He's going to be sworn in. What would you write for him to say, or what would you like to hear him say? What sentiment in regards to the healing that needs to take place in this country?
Well, I would like to hear him say that we're all Americans and that the democratic experiment is still going forward and that all of us have a role in it. I frankly don't think that's what we're likely to hear. It was one of the things that I liked the most about President Obama's farewell speech is that he talked so much about the underappreciated fundamentals of democratic discipline and voting and citizenship and that we're all responsible for this country and what we the people means and how optimistic that is. And I think all of us are going to have to reach down to try to advance that perspective if it comes under assault during a Trump presidency.
All right. Thank you so much, Taylor Branch, for being with us this hour, and to Mary Elliott from the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Thank you both very much. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton, with help today from Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, along with Timothy Olmsted here at WAMU. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brendan Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny in this special broadcast from WAMU in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.